You're listening to the GNU World Order, episode 1 of season 11. Hi everyone, this is Klaatu, and this is season 11, episode 1 of the GNU World Order. Welcome back. In today's episode, we're going to talk about Microsoft's new Windows subsystem for Linux, or whatever it's called, WSL. We're also going to talk about MakeSelf, the self-extracting archive format that's been around for ages. You've just never really known about it, and certainly you've never made one, I hope. And so we're going to talk about it today in this episode. It was March of this year, so March 2016, that Microsoft announced that they'd written a compatibility layer of sorts, technically known as WSL, which is Windows Subsystem for Linux, or something like that, so that ELF binaries, which is the format used by Linux, so it's colloquially synonymous to Linux binaries, could run on top of Windows. I don't usually really care so much about Microsoft news. I don't really get affected by what they do in my real, like, everyday life. But I do think that this topic, not just this Windows subsystem for Linux thing, but just general Microsoft attitude towards open source might be worth commenting on. If not as a note on technical trends, then possibly just for historical perspective. So, I know that back in October of 2015, I was at the All Things Open conference, and there was a Microsoft booth there. And it was kind of one of those things where it was sort of the elephant in the room, I guess, but it was also the very deliberate elephant in the room. You know, it was very much kind of like, look, we're Microsoft, we're at your open source conference. We're just here to be here. We're not trying to say anything, we're not trying to threaten you, we're not doing anything, we're just here. We just showed up. You know, and it's like, there's like this sort of undercurrent of, but you're Microsoft and you're here, so you must know that that's going to cause people to sort of think that's odd. You know that's going to get the reaction, but you're pretending like you don't want a reaction, but you're also kind of inviting the reaction. So, I mean, it felt very deliberate, kind of like, yes, we are here. We're not wearing polo shirts. They were all wearing T-shirts. And they were handing out quirky stickers, you know, for your laptop. There was, like, a cat riding on a Tyrannosaurus Rex, waving a Microsoft flag, or a Windows flag, rather. You know, and it was like, oh, wow, this is all so quirky and down to earth. It's like, you know, it was almost like they were trying to act as if though they were sort of like the fans of Microsoft, you know, like, we're not really Microsoft, we're the indie side of Microsoft, we connect with you guys, we're like you, we're open source, basically, you know, and it just felt really awkward, but at the same time kind of appropriate, because, I mean, Windows is, like, Microsoft is a technical company. I mean, they are kind of a big deal in computing, you know? I mean, like, whether you like them or hate them or ignore them or embrace them, it's just kind of like they are there. So it's not really that big of a deal that they were at the open source conference, but then for them to act like it was a different Microsoft or something, I don't know, it just felt very strange it just felt deliberate. Now, of course, around the same time, possibly a little bit earlier, I don't really exactly remember, but they started the Microsoft Loves Open Source campaign, or Microsoft Loves Linux, or something like that. I don't remember what the... I can see the screenshot, the picture from the conference in my head. I can't remember what the sign says. But yeah, you know, you've seen it. It's, you know, Microsoft Heart Linux, or Microsoft Heart Open Source, I forget which. And it was kind of this very sort of big deal when their CEO dude announced it, that they're actually really, really quite fond of open source, and you know, Windows always has been. And then in March 2016, as I said, they unveiled their Linux subsystem, which hooks into the NT kernel, and it's currently usable as a beta in dev mode, which I don't know what any of that means. And it specifically translates POSIX syscalls to whatever NT listens for and responds accordingly. So it's providing, I said compatibility layer, but I guess really it's almost just an abstraction layer. I mean, there's obviously some compatibility layer, because there have got to be libraries to respond to these things. But the point being, there's no emulation, there's no recompile. It is running an ELF binary that was compiled, you know, on Linux or whatever, and you're running it on Windows, and things like the Windows user folder, whatever that is called or wherever that's located, becomes your $home. External devices that you plug in end up in a sort of a device tree slash media slash dev. I don't know. So it's not virtualized, it's not emulated. It's native NT libraries in order to run the ELF binaries that you would run on anything else, specifically on Ubuntu. From what I understand, it's all sort of from the Ubuntu repository or whatever. Okay, so there you go. That's what they're up to. That's what they've been doing. But like, what does it all mean? That's the big question. Yeah, what does this mean to us? Obviously, the community is not a monolithic thing. You can't say, well, this means exactly this to us. There are lots of different things that it could mean to the community, and it could even mean a lot of different things to each one of us, actually. Certainly, I've gone through a lot of different thought processes. You know, one of the things is, you kind of could see it as an admission of defeat on Microsoft's part. If you think about it, Windows binaries have been unofficially available on Linux through the sheer power of independent hacker tenacity and ingenuity for years and years and years and years. And that's been without any help from anyone. And only just now are Linux binaries being given a compatibility layer from a corporate sponsor for Windows. So not only did Linux do it first and without help, but the great and powerful Microsoft is now bowing down to pressure and finally admitting that it's actually worth running Linux binaries on Windows, which does seem pretty significant. I mean, no matter how you look at it, whether there are ulterior motives there or not, whether there's a benefit to Microsoft or not, the admission of defeat is rather implicit. Like, look, we're gonna acknowledge that you guys exist now, and we're going to actually run your applications on Windows. We're gonna let people do that. That's a big deal. I mean, it really is, because it took some man hours. I don't know whose man hours. A little bit more on that later, but it took man hours to come up with this system. So it's a big deal, and they're giving it an official stamp of some approval, and that's a big deal. I mean, in many ways, that's a lot more than Apple has actually ever done. Although obviously there are lots of similarities here, but I mean, in terms of Apple, you know, they do sort of maintain an X11 application called XQuartz. It's horrible, very out of date, not well done, and they don't even really condone it officially. It's kind of on the open source portal of Apple's web empire, and it's not well supported, and they don't really talk about it a whole lot, and they don't seem to really acknowledge the name Linux. They talk about Unix a lot, but not really Linux, you know. So it's kind of interesting that Microsoft is being a little bit more adult-like. You know, they're being more grown up. They're actually acknowledging entities sort of by name, and you know, they're kind of hesitate to say they're giving anyone any respect, but that's certainly how they're spinning it, and they're spinning it, I think, more respectfully than Apple does. That's one way of seeing it, anyway. The other way might be that you could see Microsoft attempting to gobble up open source and open source culture. After all, Windows tried it one way for decades, you know, and then another way for more decades, and they're just trying these different angles, you know. Like, first they hated Linux completely, and then they were like, well, Linux is, you know, it exists and it's okay, but I mean, the total cost of ownership, we've all heard that one, right? I mean, even within my time, we've heard that one. Total cost of ownership on Linux is actually much, much more than on Windows. Like, you don't really want to go down that path. And now suddenly it's like, oh, well, actually, we love Linux. You know, I mean, have you ever, I mean, like, when I was a kid, I remember, you know, I would do these things to try to get out of, like, eating my vegetables or whatever kids don't like. Which is funny, because now I'm a vegetarian, but like, you know, like, I would try one thing, like hiding my vegetables under a napkin or something, and then try hiding it under my plate, and then suddenly I would say that I was sick, you know, like, I felt sick to my stomach, I couldn't eat anymore, you know, and it's just kind of like, the adults in the room just kind of, like, we know you want to get from point A to point B, and we see that every different thing that you are trying is an effort to get from A to B. So, like, even though in the kid's mind, like, I'm trying totally different things here, like, this will really trick them, it's like, to the adult mind, it's kind of like, we see what you're doing. And that's kind of how I feel about Microsoft right now, you know? It's kind of like, okay, well, we haven't tried this yet. The people will never catch on. Let's just try this. You know, it's like, first we hate Linux, then Linux is just too expensive for practical use. Linux is insecure, it's not secure enough, open source isn't secure. And now it's like, oh, open source is great, we love it. It's like, we don't actually believe that you've changed your mind. We actually think you're still trying to get the same thing as you've always been trying, and you're just using a different tactic. Like, to any rational mind, it's super obvious, and it's a little bit embarrassing because it is that obvious. But again, that's just one other way to see it. There are other ways to see it. You could see it as the perfect win-win situation, and you'd have a good argument to make there. I mean, Microsoft adopts some GNU applications. Linux gets a stamp of approval from Microsoft. You know, you can brag to your friends that use Linux, and then if they say, oh, Linux, and you can say, hey, Microsoft said it was okay, and they're like, and they'll be like, oh, well, okay, well, yeah, we admit Linux is kind of cool. You know, so you get kind of approval, the capital A. You get approval with your boss, too, you know? It's like, hey, I want to switch this server over to Linux. We only use Microsoft here. Yeah, but look, your Microsoft says Linux is okay. And he's like, oh, okay, we'll go for it. It's kind of cool, you know? If you go to work every morning and you have to use Windows, and you're like, I really want to install Linux, and the boss is saying, no, you have to use Microsoft. Well, how about if I just install this Bash terminal, because Microsoft says it's okay. Okay, go for it. You know, so it really is in a lot of different ways. It is the perfect win-win situation. So those are lots of different ways to see the same thing, and probably none of them are wrong. Probably all of them are at least a little bit right. But beyond sort of just reacting to all of this, what's really going on here? I mean, the GPL and the BSD and all those licenses, MIT, Apache, and all those, they encourage people and companies to take code and to use the code, and, of course, just as importantly, to share the code. So sharing software isn't really, like, just a cultural thing in open source. It's in our bylaws. It's an ethic rather than a moral, you know? It's like something that we insist upon. It's like, it's not something we encourage, it's like, no, really, share this, you know? So Microsoft ingesting ELF binaries is, no matter what, a really good thing. It is exactly what open source has been encouraging people to do. It's frustrating that closed source companies refuse to integrate free code, and I've said so before. You know, it's little things like EXT, EXT3, EXT4, JFS, simple open source file systems. I would love to be able to read these on closed source operating systems when necessary. And no matter what, you can't get a closed source company to support that. Open source codecs. Would love to be able to play open source codecs on closed source platforms. And no matter what, you just can't get them to support it. And the logic doesn't exist, you know? It's just like this total breach of logic. You're like, look, we're asking no work from you. All we want you to do is bundle this code into your thing. And they'll come up with excuses, you know? Oh, well, we can't be sure that's not patent encumbered. What a load of nonsense. You can't be sure that it's not patent encumbered. Yes, you can. It's open source. The company is saying it's free to use. Use it. There will never be any lawsuit against anyone who uses this code. It's open source, and you can use it. Like, what more do you need to be sure that something is not patent encumbered? You know, it's just, it's total nonsense. It's just belligerence and FUD, and it's really frustrating. So we want closed source companies to do this sort of thing. We want Microsoft users, willing or otherwise, to have the option, at least on some level, even if they have to go into dev mode, we want them to have the option to own not just their data, but also the code that they're using to create that data. We want it to be an option for them to look at the source code, to learn from it, to improve it. That's what open source is all about. Like, that's the whole thing. So Microsoft saying that they suddenly are, quote, in love with open source is a really, really good thing, because there's, to some degree, to a very large degree, there's not really a way that can be a bad thing in the purest sense of what open source is trying to do. Open source is saying keep the source code open and shareable. So if Microsoft is going to accept that, then that's a good thing. Now, I realize that Microsoft as a corporation has been around for a long time. You know, they're not new by any means to this scene. But their attitude to open source so far has basically got them looking like the newest user of Ubuntu out there. You know, like, you know, that guy on the forums? That's what they look like right now. Just picture that person on the forums, that, you know, the one I'm talking about. That's Microsoft right now. And that's not unusual. It's not a bad thing necessarily. I mean, it is, we've all been there. You know, like, I didn't download VLC for the first time as a kid in order to see what I could do for the project. I downloaded it because it was doing a better job of playing all the media that I had than anything else, you know, the company that I was using had given me. So at some point, we're all that kind of newbie, like the newbie who's just like, hey, I'm here, what can you do for me? You know, that's normal. We're all that person at some point. But it does feel to me like right now, at a meeting, you know, in Microsoft headquarters, they must have had a meeting where they were looking at, you know, the latest GitHub survey results or something. And they were seeing just how many developers Linux kind of had on its side. And they must have just scratched their head and said, how can we get some of these developers over to our side? And they must have looked through all the data and tried to find exactly what was attracting all these people over to develop for Linux and all this open source stuff. And someone must have said, like, well, what about if we used the same terminology, like open and source? We could put those two words together and put it somewhere, and people could start developing open source for us. And they were all like, yeah, that's a great idea, let's do that. And that became sort of their campaign. Which is funny, because, I mean, developers have been developing open source technology on Windows for decades. I mean, there are projects out there, not just one or two, mind you, there are lots of projects out there that are open source and that only exist on Windows. I mean, you could port them to Linux because it's open source, but, I mean, in terms of the person developing it, it you know, they're just doing it for Windows. And that's it. I mean, that's what open source is. So why did Microsoft, like, have to then say, oh, well, we love open source? You know, it's like, you've had open source for years, for decades, for probably a very long time. Open source, like, probably half of open source was even done on Windows, because Linux didn't exist yet, you know? I mean, I know that Unix did, and there was a lot of development there, but I mean, people developing code and sharing code is not, it's not really a new thing. It didn't just pop up with Linux, and it didn't just pop up with GitHub. It's been around. So it's odd that they feel the need now to sort of bang on this drum of saying, hey, we've got open source now, we're aware of it, we're cool with it, so you should all come over to us and start developing for us. And it's a little bit strange, I think, that in order to get all of this going, they apparently had to work directly with Canonical. Like, at the Microsoft Build 2016 conference, where they announced this whole Windows Subsystem for Linux, or whatever it's called, WSL, they did so. They announced it as a joint thing with Canonical developers. So it's kind of strange to me that they had to team up with Canonical to make this happen, because it's open source, right? I mean, that's the whole point. Like, that's the big deal, is that it's open source, and Microsoft loves open source. So why did they not just take the code and integrate it as needed themselves? Like, why did they have to hire or borrow or make a deal with Canonical in order to make this happen? Like, what? Why did it need to be a corporate deal in order to make this open source thing happen? And furthermore, what's maybe even funnier is that the Windows system for Linux, or whatever it is, WSL, is not, at least as yet, open source. So just to be clear, Microsoft loves open source. Canonical is a vendor of open source, and so they're going to come together to bring open source to developers by producing closed source code. Obviously, the attitude here is still very much, what can you do for me? If you're an open source developer, you're welcome at Microsoft. Just as long as you purchase the Windows license and work within Microsoft's guidelines, don't think about the closed source underneath you. Just put the stickers on the laptop like the real hackers do. Listen to the webinars about how much Microsoft adores open source, and get back to work writing for Windows. That's kind of the message that's being sent on a subliminal level. It's essentially the message that has to be sent, because no matter what, Windows itself is not open source. So you're on a closed stack no matter what. And so they do love open source. It's just within certain conditions. It's within a certain constraint. So it is cool that they love open source, but what does that mean outside of Windows? I think that Microsoft, being not illegal apparently, but a monopoly, essentially, I think that the fact that Microsoft is claiming to, has to say that they love open source, you know? It's like one of those things where there's action and then there's words. And I respect that they're really, really trying to temper the two. They're trying to bring those two somewhat closer together. So they're not just saying that they love open source. They are actually, in some weird way, producing actions to prove that they love open source. But the fact that they have to blatantly say it, and that they're producing it by producing closed source, and they're doing all of these things, and it's kind of like, well, I get that you want us to believe that you love open source, and I get that you could be suing us. So it's, you certainly, between this and being sued, I'm going to admit that this is the better option. But why wouldn't you, as the world's monopoly, computer monopoly, why wouldn't you use some of your influence to actually change the industry toward a more open sourcey kind of mindset? I mean, I don't know if I can say this strong enough because I spend a lot of my time downplaying how big of a deal Microsoft is because it's not for me. But if you really think about it, like, I mean, there's no question about go the whole laptop buying experience. I mean, if you go out and buy a laptop, you are buying a Windows laptop, and then you're going to take it home and you're going to hope that Linux runs on it in all the different and subtle ways that you need Linux to run on it. But at the store, you're purchasing a Windows laptop, and you are, and you're purchasing a Windows laptop that has had the BIOS or the UEFI written specifically for Windows, like to Microsoft's specifications. Like, that's how much Microsoft matters really to the world. I mean, it's everywhere. So if Microsoft wanted to, they could put their foot down. And I say that as opposed to saying waving their magic wand, because I understand that it's a big industry. But I mean, Microsoft is the reason that that industry exists. So they could put their foot down and say, you know what? The drivers for external devices are going to be open source code from now on. Or at least there's going to be a standard. And if you write a driver that doesn't adhere to this Microsoft standard, which also happens to be an open spec, then we're not going to make it a certified magical Microsoft whatever. And if they did that, then basically overnight, the driver situation for all computer peripherals would change completely. You would not be able to purchase a device that didn't just plug and play on any computer, because Microsoft said that you had to adhere to this standard, and it would happen just like that. And the same thing goes with firmware blobs and video codecs and file systems and all these different things. Like, all they have to do is make a declaration, and the industry will change for Microsoft, because the industry cannot not change for Microsoft. That's just how it is. Like, that's, love it or hate it, they're the reason that the computer industry exists. It's all sitting on Microsoft. Microsoft doesn't sit on top of the other computer on top of computer manufacturers. Computer manufacturers sit atop Microsoft, and that's really what annoys, like, if you had to ask me about Microsoft, and if I had to answer, then that would be the thing. That would be the one thing that annoyed me about Microsoft at the end of the day, because that's the only thing that ever actually impacts me, is that when I buy a device for a computer, I'm hoping that some clever Linux developer has reverse engineered the drivers, or I'm hoping that a company has done the outrageous and actually written Linux drivers for that device, or I'm just hoping that that it's adhered to some kind of open standard, and everyone's agreeing to get along nicely with that standard. And that's not all of the time true, but if Microsoft wanted it to be, it could be an official standard. Like, that's what they could bring to the table for open source. And that would be pretty darned meaningful to a lot of people. So that's what I expect, I guess, from Microsoft. And it's a big demand, I guess, and you might come up with lots of reasons over why they wouldn't want to do that and why they shouldn't have to do that, and that's asking too much. But really, like, I'm just asking for action rather than chatter. And right now, everything that Microsoft has done has been very specific to benefit Microsoft. And I think that if you were in a relationship with someone, if they acted that way, you'd have your doubts about their intentions and their sincerity. And it kind of goes the same way in business, Like, if Microsoft can only be bothered to produce stuff that's going to happen to benefit them, then you do kind of have to wonder just how much they love open source and love Linux. And sure, yeah, it's better than being sued, but I don't know if that's the best measure of appreciation or not. Now, the thing is, if you look at this, you can be as critical as you want. It doesn't really matter, right? All of this is fine. It's Microsoft, if this is how they want to treat open source, it's within their rights to do so. As I said, that's kind of what open source is all about. But I fear that Microsoft is going to find open source a little bit shallow if this is how they approach it. I don't mean intellectually shallow. I mean it's going to be like a shallow fountain. Open source thrives because it's a give and take economy. A developer takes code from one place and improves it and releases it, gets it published or publishes it, posts it somewhere, shares it, and it just continues to grow. And it becomes training ground for someone else, and they take it, and and it keeps growing, and it thrives, and it's developed, and there's lots of different reasons for these things to happen. And sometimes, I mean, that's how it's supposed to happen, and sometimes it doesn't necessarily happen that way. And when we do it wrong, it usually comes back and sort of bites us, meaning that if you approach open source as a user and you're just all about what it can do for you and expectation and well, this open source stuff, it's just not doing it right, and all of these things that we all sometimes have felt when especially as new users. At some point, if you're never giving back and you're just taking and taking and taking, and you're never willing, at least even, and when I say give back, I don't even mean you have to like, give back. I mean, even if it's just taking an afternoon to configure something so that it works the way that you want it to work, and acknowledge that not everyone agrees with you, and just because this thing doesn't happen when you plug this thing in. That doesn't mean that it's not well written. It just means that someone didn't think that it should do that. And the fact that you do just means that you have to change it for yourself. So if you're not willing to do that, then it does end badly. You get disgusted with how open source isn't making enough money for you, or you get disgusted because people are looking at the code and pointing out errors and you feel insecure about that, or you're maybe you feel like you're losing control of your project because people are doing stuff with your code, or maybe you, like I say, can't be bothered to change something for yourself because you can't accept that not everyone wants the OS to act exactly the way that you want the OS to act. And you walk away and you switch to something else and you get angry and none of us wants that to happen. That's not the result of open source that any of us want. We all want to be happy with open source. We want other people to be happy with it and to free and to feel like it's yours, it's your thing that you can mold and make into your own. So if Microsoft expects to treat open source as nothing but like a free-flowing idea fountain from which they can draw all of these ideas and all this free code from, and they're never going to have to give anything meaningful back other than a bunch of hype and marketing and maybe some free server space or something. I think that they're going to find eventually that the experience is unfulfilling. It's not going to bring them the influx of passionate developers that they expect, because it's not going to make any of their closed source code any better. It's not going to make people trust them or love them anymore. It's just going to disappoint and possibly disgust them, and they're going to come, they're going to go away disenfranchised by their own lack of participation. And nobody really does want that. That's not what open source is about. So hopefully Microsoft is going to surprise me, and they're going to start contributing back in a very meaningful and actually selfless way. They own their code, so it's up to them to open it. But they also, by extension, own much of the data that their users produce. So maybe a good start is to earn trust of people with open standards, open formats, that kind of thing. Keep Windows closed, but keep everything else open. Like I say, industry impact. They could create some open standards that would allow people to use open source with or without Windows. That would be good. So, I mean, open source is not a club. That's the takeaway lesson here. It's not a social club. Microsoft doesn't have to buy its way in. They don't have to trick us into believing that they're open. You know? None of this is necessary. Open source has existed on Microsoft for ages. There's no sign-up sheet. You get called, quote, open source, close quote, by producing open source. So if you start doing that, Microsoft, then things will truly change. And that's about all I have to say about that. It's time for a coffee break. I think you'll agree. I am drinking, I found this coffee from a local coffee vendor called La Fer. And the coffee itself is called Panama Hartman. I don't know why. I think it's a person's name. But it's really, really good. And I wanted to just kind of mention it. A long time ago, I used to say very frequently that my favorite coffee was Sawtooth Mountain Mud from a little cafe. I think it's called like the Watering Hole or something like that, up in Joshua Tree, California, of all places. And I haven't had it in such a long time, but I feel almost like it's difficult for me to say that that's my favorite anymore, because it's been such a long time. But either way, whether it's still my favorite or not, I have to say that this Panama Hartman stuff is actually quite good. It's really, really mild, which, I mean, so is Sawtooth Mountain Mud, which is why I made that reference. Really mild. And I'm not saying that I like necessarily mild coffees. I'm just, for some reason, when I drink a mild coffee, I think a lot of it, because I'm like, wow, this is bold enough to be mild. You know, that could be a marketing catchphrase right there. And so the flavor of this one is, I would say, it's kind of got like this weird sort of back flavor, which again, so did Sawtooth. It's kind of got this flavor that comes back at you after you've been drinking it for a while. And it's, I almost want to say, like, it's the sort of back flavor of honey. If you've ever had a really good, strong honey. Like, I'm not saying that when it's on your tongue, like, that's not the flavor. I'm talking about, like, that sort of the after aroma, almost, of it. It's really, really good. And I have no idea how you could possibly get it. I don't know if it's, like, oh, it's from Panama. Apparently, you can go to Panama and get Panama Hartman from the Hartman Estate. So do that. It's really good. Do it now, I mean. And I'll play the coffee break music and you can actually enjoy Panama Hartman with me. Thank you. cup of coffee. I hope you enjoyed yours, and I hope you did go get a Panama Hartman, because I'll be very, very disappointed if you did not. Either way, it tasted great. And we should now talk about the thing that I wanted to talk about today, which is Make Self. So that's M-A-K-E-S-E-L-F. I don't know if you can hear the rain outside. It's absolutely ferociously windy and rainy this afternoon. Just mention that just in case you can hear it. Anyway, so Make Self. So Make Self is like this, an archiving tool. And you've experienced it. You don't maybe know that you've experienced it, but you have. Make Self is a self-extracting archive. So, for instance, when you run an NVIDIA installer, like if you've downloaded the NVIDIA driver for a graphics card and you've run that, if you've done that, you'll know that it downloads a, you know, NVIDIA underscore whatever, whatever dot run, dot R-U-N, I think. And if you launch that thing, then actually what it is a self-contained archive, or a self-extracting archive. So when you run it, it extracts itself and then launches some code that it's been told to launch internally, and it then runs a program. So it feels like it's some like incredible fancy, you know, installer application, and I'm sure it to some degree is, but what's really happening is that it's just an archive, and you extract it and it launches something automatically. It's all very fluid. Other examples of this would have been, I think, Loki or maybe id, one of those two companies' software back in the day. This was before my time, but I'm told they distributed self-extracting archives with the extension, I think, .run was their sort of an invention of theirs. So, you know, some doom.run or quake.run, I don't, again, this is way before my time, so, I mean, my Linux time, I mean, I was alive, it's before I started using Linux, and certainly before I started playing games, so, but yeah, they did that, so you'll see these things, you see them, you know, still, I think, GOG, GOG.com, if you go to GOG.com, there are some Linux games, some new, but I think their specialty seems to be older games, like Baldur's Gate and stuff like that. You can buy them from GOG.com, and when you download them, and they're .run files, I think, or maybe just .sh, I don't remember. But either, again, you run them, you launch them, and they self-extract, and they launch an installer, which I think actually is that one installer, NixStaller. And it launches and runs and installs, and then you're done, and it's all very kind of, it's very clean is what it is. It's not beyond anything else, it's just, it's a very kind of clean process, and that kind of makes it pleasant to use, you know, because it's simple and it's kind of self-contained, which I guess is another thing that's kind of nice, because if you think about like an RPM or a .deb file or something like that, or even just a raw .tgz, they exist, but you kind of always have to rely on something else, you know? It's like RPM, well, what am I going to be able to install it with today? Is it going to open in the RPM app store thing on my computer, or is that going to error out? Because half the time it's going to error out. Okay, well, it didn't work. Okay, well, I'll just drop down to the command line and do a yum install and see if that works. If that works, then I'm good to go. If not, alright, I'll try something different. You know, same thing with the deb. Are we going to be able to do it? Is it going to launch? Is it going to tell me that there's some kind of error because this thing isn't labeled correctly or something? Or is it just going to work and be really nice? And if it's a .tgz, then what do? We extract it first, and then we look at it, and then we look for an installer tip, nothing. Okay, well, we'll just maybe just extract it to /usr, or /, and just hope it sprinkles all the files where they're supposed to go. Did that work? Yes, okay, then we're good to go. So, yeah, Make Self, it's kind of like one of those things. you download the stupid thing, you click on it, and it runs, and you're going, you're installing. Like, that's it. There's no thought process involved. It's you run the thing, and it's now installing. And that, you have to admit, is nice. So, Make Self has existed, and it continues to exist, and it's a 100% shell script. It doesn't rely on anything really crazy. You know, you don't have to install anything really certainly you don't have to install anything to receive a make self file. I mean, it's a self-extracting thing. If you receive it and you have Linux, then you run it and it runs, and it's that simple. So you can check it out at Stephane Peter. That's stephaneper.com/makeself. And you can download it as a zip file or a tar GZ file, and you can pretty much start using it right away for your own purposes. And that's what we'll do right now, just to see what it does, what it's all about. So if you do download it and you extract it, tar mega step dash make self, and then if we go into that folder, then you see that it consists basically of two pieces, and that's the weird thing about this, and I honestly haven't really figured out yet how I want to install this thing on my computer. And I'm not even sure if I want to install it on my computer, because it might just be one of those things that I use kind of locally. The weird thing about it, though, is that there's a makeself-header.sh and a makeself. So makeself.sh is the thing that you use to make yourself extracting files, and the makeself header is the thing that gets bundled into your file that you make. So if you were to install it, you would have to then tell MakeSelf where its headers are so that it could then correctly make your thing. So what we'll do, just to demonstrate, is we'll make a directory. We'll call it test. And then if we go into our test directory, we will make two different things. We'll make a payload file, which you can just cat anything into. I'm just going to echo 1, 2, 3 bar into payload. And then we'll also make an executable script. So we'll make that. We'll do the shebang /usr/bin/bash. And let's do something simple like we'll set the current working environment CWE to read link, so actually backtick read link -F $0 backtick. So that'll set the current working environment to bizarrely the file that got executed. So that's basically to itself. And then what we're going to do, you'll see the method to this madness now, is we'll cat backtick dir name $CWE, so that's just the directory leading up to this file, /payload, outside of the backtick, let's put a little test file in /temp/hello. That's what we'll do. Okay, so in other words, we're writing a script to look in the current directory of itself and to cat the contents of a file called payload into a file in our temp directory, temp hello. I'm doing that because I just want to see proof that this thing did the thing that I asked it to do. That's all this is. So that's our test directory, test, and it contains our payload and an executable shell script, bash script. And we'll go ahead and mark that executable file as executable, so that's chmod plus x /script.sh, or whatever you called it. And now I think we're ready. So to do this, to make it, to make our test directory into a self-extracting entity, we'll do a /makeself.sh, because we're in the makeself directory, so we need to tell it to run the makeself.sh in the current directory. And then we'll point it to the directory that we want archived, so that's test. And we give it the name of the archive that we want to create. So I'll just call that Looky. And then a comment. So we'll just call this in quotes, quote A space test space package, close quote. And then at last, the startup script contained within our archive. And that is, of course, I called mine script.sh. So we'll do a /script.sh because it's relative to the self-extracting archive. So /script.sh is the thing that I want to be executed upon unarchiving. So I'll hit return there, and it's you know, fairly verbose, so it tells me exactly what it did. It says that the header is 511 lines long, so that means that I've just added 511 lines of new code to my archive. And then it compresses 20 kilobytes of data, which is told to me. It's /script.sh/payload, and then, oops, a bunch of backup stuff that I have Emacs creating for myself, which I probably didn't really want in there, but that's okay. And it gives me the MD5 sum, and that's it. So it's created this thing called Looky. So now if I look at my folder, ls, indeed, there is something called Looky. And actually, I should have, you know what, I'm going to call that Looky.run so that we know what it is. All right, so now it's looky.run. So now if I do a /looky.run --help, this is the cool thing about these things, which probably you don't even know, you know, you don't know this is an option, which I guess is kind of a bad thing about them, because, you know, if you do a file, for instance, file looky.run, it just tells you, hey, this is a POSIX shell script executable binary data. Well, okay, so it's a shell script, but it's got binary data in it. What does that really mean? You know, it doesn't really self-identify. It's like, is this a make self thing, or is this something not good? Like, you don't really know what to do with it. But it turns out if you do a looky.run --help, it actually gives you a bunch of options for yourself so that you don't have to necessarily you know, run these things blindly. And that's quite nice. So you can do, for instance, a /looky.run --no exec, and that would do the self-extraction, and it would not run the embedded script after the extraction. That's kind of nice. You can do a /looky.run --keep to extract and not delete the data that it extracted, which is also handy because its default action is to extract, run or not run if you told it not to, you know, no exec, and then delete what it extracts. So if you pass both --no exec --keep, then you are left with a test directory with all of the contents, or a directory with all the contents of that thing, which in my case is called test. And sure enough, if you look in it, script.sh payload. So they're there. And then you could look at the shell script to see what exactly it's going to do to your system. And then once you're confident with it, you could say, okay, well, this meets with my approval. This is what I thought I was, I was looking at this with. So, we will actually run it now. So then you could just do a /looky run, And then if you do a cat temp hello, sure enough, it echoed or catted the contents of payload into temp hello. And so what we thought was going to happen did in fact happen. And that's make self. It's a pretty handy little tool, simply because sometimes you do want things to happen fairly automatically. And if you are clever, then you can make a shell script and set that as the, you know, the startup shell script, as it were, upon unarchiving, and have all kinds of things happen. You know, so if you're giving an application to someone, to a noob, and you don't want to have to talk them through all the different steps of installing these things or whatever it is, then you can give them one of these things, and if, as long as they can launch as long as they can launch a clickable icon, then they should be able to find their way through this process. Of course, it'll depend on their distribution and how their distribution, their desktop, and how their desktop deals with, like, hey, you clicked on something that wants to be launched in a terminal, so what am I going to do with it? Do you want to open the file, or did you want to run it in a terminal? And if you want to run it in a terminal, do you want to see it? And, you know, all these other stupid options that a lot of people get confused about. But as long as they can navigate that much, then the hard work could be done ostensibly by the make self archive that you distribute. Is there a potential for abuse here? Yeah, of course, technically. I mean, you're giving people an archive that will launch code, you know, just in the act of being unarchived. That, to me, feels really dangerous. On the other hand, it also feels, it feels like as long as you know it exists, there are sort of safeguards to protect you against it just playing havoc on your system. But you probably, you want to keep this in mind. You know, I mean, it never really occurred to me that that was a thing until I finally got curious about how these installers that I was coming across, how do they do that? You know, you click on them, they're just labeled .run or whatever, and you click on them and they launch applications, installers and stuff, and like, how is that working? How is this, what's the technology there? And that's how I found MakeSelf. And so it is a little bit, it's an interesting technology, and yeah, it could be abused. So now that you know about it, maybe you'll be less likely to be abused in that way. Of course, you know, the other side of all of this is that it's been around for ages. This isn't new. And even so, I guess just because it's been around doesn't mean that it can't be used later for abuse. But now that you know that you can do a dash dash help and then look at a bunch of different things, you can figure out, you know, you can look for these things and say, oh, this is a make self. I'm gonna look at this before I allow it to execute on my system. So now you know. But either way, whatever you're really intending on doing with it, it is an interesting technology. And I can really definitely see it being handy, you know, in real life occasions. I can see myself using this. So, make self. Okay, I think that's it for this episode. Thank you very much for listening, as always. My name is Klaatu. You can find me online at GNUWorldOrder.info or at SlackerMedia.info. You can find me via email at Klaatu@member.fsf.org. That's member.fsf, as in Free Software Foundation.org. And you can also find me on linuxquestions.org as notklaatu. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next time.